The myth of the Chosen One is one of the most popular and enduring myths in human history. You know this one. It always starts out with some poor schlub who has a garbage life, gets approached by a mysterious stranger or outsider who shows him a wonderful world that he never knew existed. Not only is this person a part of this new world, but they are the chosen one that has been foretold, destined to rule or to conquer or some such. If it all sounds familiar, it's because this is Star Wars, this is Kingsman, this is Matrix, this is Buffy, this is Harry Potter. This is like 90% of comic books and at least 90% of world religions as well. But this chosen one story that I'm about to tell you, this one is different from all the others. This one is a real world example of that story, of that myth. You may or may not remember The Machinist. It was further out west. But if you do remember The Machinist, and you think that he was just some psycho with a cult following, then you're dead wrong. The man named John Sunday was a chosen one. This is his story. The Machinist, Part 1. The Boy Who Should Not Have Lived. Drinking whiskey in the kitchen and telling scary stories around the fire. Music, monsters, and mayhem, killers, cannibals, and cults, fearful fiction and furious fact, tall tales, and terrible truths. This is A Scary Home Companion. Up until that night when he was six, John Sunday had been a pretty normal kid. But then the red robes came, sinister figures wearing crude wooden masks. They came into his bedroom and silently carried him out into the yard. They made him sit on the grass and watch on as his mother and father were both tied up on pentagrams made of straw and then set on fire. He watched as his baby sister, still a toddler, was carried off, screaming into the darkness. Part of him wanted to chase after her, to help, to calm Rachel down. But he knew that he couldn't, so he just sat there, blank-faced and empty. And then a man approached him. This man was a little different from the others. He wore black robes and a red mask, which he removed when he sat down on the ground next to John. He said to him, "My name is Mr. Horrid, and we think that you are a very special little boy, John Sunday. You have a very special life ahead of you. Your sister? Don't worry about her. You will see her again. And you will see me again, too, one day." Mr. Horrid left him alone, sitting there. And there began the education of John Sunday. This boy was sent into the system. Anybody who knows anything about the system knows that it's no place for a kid. Usually, it just breeds victims or victimizers. But in this particular case, maybe that's what they were looking for. He got kicked around for a while and then ended up in a remote state-run boarding school, mostly for the kids that nobody else wanted. John was a slightly built child, but there was something about him, the way he carried himself. He might have looked like a shy, bespectacled bookworm, but he carried himself differently, and he rarely blinked, so whenever he looked at somebody, it felt like he was staring right through them. This made him not so popular, but it also made it so everybody left him alone. And this is how John liked it. He did decent in school, mostly excelled in biology and anatomy, and he did demonstrate an interest in machines. He went to this boarding school, existing peacefully, for a couple of years. And then a new kid transferred in. A big kid, a tough bully type, who for whatever reason set his sights on John right away. Every day he took John's lunch from him. And when John would yell at him, hit him on the back, the bully would just walk away laughing, saying, "I can't hear you. I can't hear you." After two or three days of this, John simply stopped chasing after him. He wasn't going to give him the satisfaction. Instead, he waited. He watched. He learned the bully's schedule, and he was patient. And then one evening, the bully happened to come across John waiting for him in an empty hallway. Held in each hand, hidden behind his legs, John was holding a pair of very sharp number two pencils. And before the bully knew what was happening, John had jammed one of those pencils deep into his ear canals and then snapped them off. The bully fell to the ground, clutching his head and screaming, "I can't hear you, I can't hear you." John didn't laugh, but he seemed content in his work. From there, John was sent to a foster home. Why not a jail, you may ask? Well, John never asked that question, and no one ever mentioned why. He was just quietly transferred to another city, another state, another place, another bureaucracy. Strings being pulled from on high. As soon as he got set up in this new school, this new house, this new place, he started ditching school. He found an abandoned warehouse in an industrial, squalid part of the city, and he set up a playroom in there where he would take apart dead animals that he found. Well, not just animals, it turns out. A local homeless woman called in a tip about a friend of hers that had gone missing, and the cops came looking. John didn't kill that woman. It was just like with all the animals there. The dozens of dogs and cats and rodents and birds and the two other dead bodies that were in his playpen. He'd found them all already dead due to the elements or consumption or what have you. And he just decided to use them to further his personal education. He just wanted to learn. Dissembling a corpse really wasn't hurting anybody, was it? Well, the state, it turns out, saw it a little differently. When John first arrived at the juvenile detention facility, there was a familiar face waiting for him in the holding room. "Do you remember me?" he says. "My name is Mr. Horrid. We've met once before." John didn't answer the question. The man said, not unkindly, "You did nothing wrong here, John. You know this in your heart, don't you? You were just following your instincts. We all know this. But hear me, you must be careful. Whenever you let slip that mask and they can see your true face, then they are going to fear you. So you must pretend to be like them. Do what must be done in privacy, but in public, be whatever it is that they need you to be at that time. Do you understand?" John nodded again. "We are watching you always, John. But we will not save you. We watch to see what you will do and how you will save yourself. That is how we will know that it is really you in there. Goodbye, John Sunday."
They call themselves the One True Faith. This bizarre, bloodthirsty, and some say fictional cult worshipped an ancient entity known as the Blood King. Their mission was to spread pain, suffering, and execute a realignment of the entire human race. If, of course, they exist at all. 6 years ago, the story of a man called the Machinist brought this cult into the international spotlight. Except for a nagging little detail, there wasn't any evidence. The authorities could never find this cult and could never even prove their existence. Tonight, I am joined by two men who claim to know for a fact that the cult is very real and still active to this day. The first is Professor Andre Argento. He is a scholar, a lecturer, and an author.
Hello, Miss Simpson. Always a pleasure.
Professor, you believe the one true faith exists, and you've even published a paper on that same subject last year. What prompted that?
Can I be honest, Miss Simpson? It was a cash grab, yeah. After that business with the so-called Machinist, the cult was back on the worldwide radar. It was the perfect time for a clear and concise layout of the facts.
And what are those facts, Professor?
Well, that the one true faith has been in existence for well over 300 years. In the modern era, the cult can be tied all the way back to the Leopard Men murders in Nigeria, which came just after World War I.
And these are facts, not conjecture, correct?
Historical precedent is cited repeatedly. I might have used the issue to further my own career, yeah, but that does not mean I am not telling the truth. I don't have to lie, Miss Simpson. Everything is already there.
I don't mean to imply that you are lying, Professor. It's just the dearth of evidence and all the speculation makes it...
Of course, yes, yes. But deranged as they might be, this cult is extremely well-funded, with deep roots and a wide member base. They follow a rigid, almost military hierarchy. They have a code of silence. It's legendary.
And that is what you said on the phone. That makes me extremely lucky to welcome my next guest, a man who alleges he was part of the One True Faith and managed to live to tell the tale.
To John Sunday, jail was not that much different from the boarding school or any of the other places he'd been over the years. It was rigidly controlled. He had no privacy, no freedom. The people there didn't like him, and in return, he didn't like them, but no one ever seemed to notice. The one difference was that here he got to work in the machine shop. He was using a drill press on license plates, and to him, this was akin to sitting cross-legged in the middle of a Zen butterfly garden. He was able to retreat inside his own head, and the hum of the machine just lulled him into a state of bliss. He was only allowed to work 2 hours a day there, but he would keep switching shifts as much as he could so that he could work 4, 6, 8 hours a day. He much preferred it to anything else in that facility. One day, this kid, maybe a year younger than John, starts sitting next to him in the cafeteria. Not right next to him, but at the same table. But he starts doing it every day. And after a few days, he starts sliding over the cookie desserts they get with their lunch. John doesn't take them, but he notices. Kid's name is Michael. Michael quickly finds a way to transfer into the machine shop so that he can be closer to John. They still don't talk at all. John has never once indicated that he gives a shit about Michael, but Michael just seems content to be in his orbit. After weeks go by, John finally asks him, why? What gives? Why are you always near me? Michael explains that he had noticed that no one ever picks on John Sunday. John may not look like much, but there's something about him. People leave him alone. And Michael thought that if he could just be near him, that would offer him some form of safety. John, of course, unblinking, flat out says, I will not protect you. Regardless, Michael just wants to be near him, and so he becomes a He becomes a mill house to John's Bart. Months go by, and even though they still rarely talk, Michael is always there, and John realized he'd grown accustomed to having him there. It wasn't exactly genuine affection, something that John Sunday could only half remember, and usually that feeling was just a visual of seeing his sister taken away from him. So this wasn't love or like, but it was as close as he could come, the closest he was capable of feeling at this point. I mean, Michael got him extra books from the library, never once asking about the anatomy texts or the notebooks full of machine designs that he was collecting. Michael always seemed happy to just be there. It made him feel safe. And for the most part, Michael's plan worked gangbusters. It was no secret who John Sunday was and why he was in this facility. Bullies, in or out of prison, always looked for the weakest victims. John Sunday was considered too much of a wild card. He was too potentially crazy to risk poking that bear. So when Michael was with him, he was probably as safe as he could have possibly been in that place. But he wasn't always with him, which is what led to the unfortunate incident that day in the showers. The main thugs of this particular facility were four teenage boys, all just a few months shy of being legal adults. So they had size and strength and numbers. And on this particular day, these four teenage boys caught Michael by himself in the showers. You've no doubt seen enough prison movies to know their intent. I won't get into it. They posted a man on the door and then bickered amongst the three of them which one would get to go first. John was heading to the showers himself. I mean, Michael was there at that time because he knew John's routine and wanted to be in the showers at the same time as his friend. When John got there, the lookout told him, "You need to leave." John heard Michael whimpering in the background, pleading for mercy. He shrugged, turned away, and calmly, slowly walked back to his cell. There, he withdrew two of the many shanks and shivs that he had been making and collecting over the months. He selected one that was good for stabbing and another one that was good for slicing. Placing them under the towel on his shoulder, he calmly walked back to the showers and stabbed the lookout twice in the side of the neck. The kid died instantly. John knew his anatomy. The first stab was lethal. The next one was just because he liked the feel of it the first time. When John stepped into the showers, he already had hot blood on his hands. He sees Michael there naked, on his knees, still begging, three larger boys that were all crowding around him, sort of jostling for position. Michael looked up with these pale, wide eyes to see this knight in shining armor, so to speak, riding to his rescue. He looked on entranced as John slit the throats and gouged out eyes from two of the three boys. This was the first time that John Sunday had actually taken human life, and he found the experience was much shorter than he anticipated. It was as disappointing as the first time you throw a water balloon and it pops in your hands before you can really enjoy it. The lookout, and then these two out of three attempted racists? Well, maybe they were racists, but that's beside the point. The point is that he killed the lookout and two out of those three attempted rapists with a single stroke of his shiv. But for this last one, this last bully, he slowed his hand. He regulated his breath. He allowed himself to take some time and indulge himself, to really let go and enjoy the feel of the blood splashing up on him. He knew he was going to be caught, and so instead of trying to keep this last victim quiet, he encouraged him to scream and gave him every reason to do so. The screams rang out throughout the facility. And some part of him hoped that these screams would cling to Michael, to his reputation at this place, and keep him safe in the future. John was immediately placed into solitary confinement. He was almost 17 now, and with the severity of this latest crime, they were going to have to transfer him to an adult facility, a maximum security place. Mr. Horrid and the powers that be, they've been able to work the system once or twice before, but the slaughter of four teenagers was much harder to cover up. Later that night, the door to the cell cracked open, and John saw a familiar face. "Hello, John. Your name is Mr. Horrid," the boy said. "Why did you do it, John? I told you to stay hidden." John wrestled with the question for a few seconds. He was not used to casting his thoughts into words. But finally he said, "Because he was not theirs to take. You told me to follow my instincts, and my instincts told me to take what is mine." Mr. Horrid smiled. He said, "And what do your instincts tell you now?" "They tell me that I'm going with you." Mr. Horrid smiled again.
"Philip has asked us to withhold his last name. He claims to have spent 7 harrowing months living among the members of the One True Faith. And although he is free of their influence, he still fears for his safety. Philip, thank you for joining me."
"Sure, it's good to get this out there. You know, it's just good."
"Nervous?"
"Shit, yeah, I am."
"Can you tell me how you got involved with the One True Faith?"
"Yeah, I mean, times were hard for a while. I was outdoors for maybe 6 or 7 months. I mean, when this guy started to talk to me, he started pitching it, you know? It was like a commune. He said I was called."
"And what does it mean to be called?"
They see different things in different people, you know?"
"And was it just you who was called?"
"Yeah, I mean, at first, it was just this one guy talking to me. Day came to get in the van and take the ride. There were about 8 or 9 other people there."
"So they didn't kidnap you?"
"Oh, no. It wasn't a kidnapping. I got an offer. 3 hots and a cot for manual labor out on what I thought was a farm. There was this initial offer where I was and who I was at the time. I mean, it sounded legit enough."
"And where did they take you?"
"I mean, we drove for a couple of days, I think. No windows in the back of the van, so it was hard to tell where we ended up. It was so far out, way out. Some farmland in the middle of a big forest."
"And this was the home of the One True Faith, correct?"
"Yeah, I mean, it was so big. But yeah, I mean, it was part of this farm. A lot of different crops, and there was all these different compounds there, a lot of, like, shacks and sheds. But most of it was centered around the church, the cathedral, they called it. I only went inside the once."
"And how many people would you say were there?"
"I mean, a lot of people. So many people."
"Take a guess."
"I don't know. I mean, the workers I was with, there was maybe 75 or 100 of us. Everyone above us, they were all wearing these robes and masks. So it was so hard to tell, but maybe a couple of hundred or more who lived there. I mean, there were always people coming and going. They all looked the same, but there were so many of them. A couple of times I saw a big meeting in front of the church. Those times, there must have been like 600 or 700, maybe 1,000 people.
1,000.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm racing through this story. Am I racing through this story? Am I going too fast? Just so damn excited about telling it. I always get worked up about the story. So, at this point, John is 16, almost 17. So this would have been around 98, 99, somewhere in there. I'd have to check the book again. John Sunday and Mr. Horrid were riding in the back of a stretch limo. On and on they rode. The silence stretched for hours. John was not the type to ask jackassy questions. He was okay to just sit and stare out the window. He'd never driven long distances like this before, not behind steel mesh. Mr. Horrid, he seemed content to just stare at the young man, drinking him in. So they drove through the night and on into the next morning. When they veered off the main road onto old unpaved roads, Mr. Horrid reached inside his black robes and pulled out a bundle, which he unwrapped the silk and pulled out a very old straight razor with a pearl handle. He handed it over to John and asked if it felt familiar. Once he held it, John knew that it wasn't pearl. This was burnished bone. And he looked at it, the way it glinted the sunlight in his eyes. And it did sort of feel familiar. But did he really recognize this razor, or did he just want to recognize it because he could feel that it was expected of him? He was supposed to recognize it. So maybe he did, but he certainly played it like he did. Eventually, they arrived at a remote farmhouse. A woman with a tattooed face was waiting outside for them. Mr. Horrid's about to kick him out of the limo, and John asks, "Okay, one question. What is all of this?" And Mr. Horrid explains, "This is the next step of your education, John. As you always have, we need you to just be who you were born to be. Follow your instincts. And while you're at it, learn from this woman. But you need to remember that she is with us, but she is not one of us." The woman's name was Ulu, a middle-aged native Inuit woman. And along with those face tats, she had enough scars on her hands to demonstrate that she had a long and storied history with the knife. John didn't have a bag. He had no things. He had no possessions, aside from now the straight razor. But this house was fully stocked with possessions for him. Kitchen, bedroom, closet, anything he could think of was there. Ulu gave him a tour, showed him around the new home. She kept asking him if any of it felt familiar, which quickly grew irritating. But he just didn't answer. He had been told that this person, this woman, was not on his level. So he immediately treated her like the help. At the end of the tour, Ulu leads him down to the basement, to a hidden door in the corner, and down a long, narrow hallway that leads to an amazing high-tech kill room. This is the machine shop John has always dreamed. His favorite, the drill press, but there were bench lathes, miter saws, band saws, reamers. In the corner, there was a cage set up, eyewash station, there was an incinerator. In that cage, I guess I shouldn't have glossed over this, is a woman, bound, gagged, and nude. She is a welcome home present to John. Ulu graciously leaves him to it, with a warning to clean up after himself when he's done. When the door closed, and John was alone with this poor woman, who stared at him with pleading eyes, he realized that this was the freest moment of his life. He was not bound, he was not trapped. He was not only free, but encouraged to do what he had always dreamed. It was an amazing night for him. Not for the woman in the cage. Ulu's main job was to teach John Sunday how to convincingly be a human being. He needed to be able to get along in the world, to seem like he was a person, while still being allowed to study his dark craft and hone his skills. So, over the next few months, she taught him how to drive. She taught him how to cook. She taught him how to go shopping and handle money. She taught him how to interact with people, most of all. How to smile. How to shake hands. Hey, how you doing? Not so bad. How about yourself? None of this was shit that he was comfortable with in the slightest. So she had to teach him how to do it and then teach him how to hide his own discomfort. He had to learn how to be comfortable in this human skin that he was in. They watched a lot of TV and movies together. She was always pointing out things that actors did or things that happened in the news or on reality shows that might help him blend in better. And he studied all this shit like game tapes. He was especially fond of reality shows. More months passed. It had almost been a year at this point. And John was now at the point where he didn't need supervision. He could drive into town on his own. He could run the errands. And he could take his time to watch locals, scout things out, think about what he might do one day, and remain comfortable and convincing the whole time. These people actually thought that he was one of them. So he thought he was getting pretty good at pretending. And although he liked to scout things out and think about what he might do, he never needed to hunt. And he knew that he shouldn't. But he didn't have to. There was never a shortage of living things, animal or human, that showed up in his kill room cage. At this point, he had learned to take his time, to go slow, to savor every experience. The kill room, this was the one place that he didn't have to pretend. He didn't have to wear that human skin. He was allowed to be himself, to explore who John Sunday really was. And what became disconcerting was that in these quiet moments, he wasn't sure what that meant, to be John Sunday. Ulu, at this point, was teaching him how to fake things at a higher level. Even though John was not romantically nor sexually interested in her whatsoever, but to be fair, I don't think he'd ever had those kind of feelings about anyone, male or female. She said that wasn't important. She just had to teach him how to act. He didn't have to feel it. She taught him how to hold hands, how to kiss, how to look someone in the eye and make them feel like you were interested in them. It was all valuable stuff. 1 year passes, and the black limousine returns. John found Mr. Horrid and a couple of cultists in long red robes and black wooden masks waiting for him in his own kill room. This time it was Ulu who was in the cage. "It's time to move on," Mr. Horrid said. He called it a graduation of sorts. John didn't need to be told. He understood clearly what needed to be done here. And he didn't hesitate. He gently helped Ulu from her cage, led her over, and then sat her down on her knees right in front of Mr. Horrid. And John knelt down beside her. He stroked her chin with one hand, and he looked her in the eye, like a lover would, while using the other hand to pull out that straight razor and lay her neck open down to the bone. But he held her gaze. He never looked away as she died. He held her chin there. And then when she was gone, he carried her over to the incinerator and burned her up. How did it feel? Mr. Horrod asked him. John thought about that and said, it felt like the waste of a good tool. So they drove once again, the two of them, throughout the night and into the next morning. By the time day was breaking, they had left the paved roads and started their way winding through thick forests at the base of some foothills. John wasn't sure where they were. He suspected it might be Canada. As they wound their way through this forest, John counted four different security checkpoints. Real ones. Gates, fencing, razor wire, robed, faceless men with guns. All of whom bowed and scraped when Mr. Horrod rolled down the window and they saw who was inside. After a couple more hours, those trees fell away. John found himself driving through a wide-open piece of farmland in the middle of a valley. And there, in the center of this farmland, was a bright and gleaming crown jewel. A church. This is what they called the cathedral. This was the spiritual center for the one true faith. Even though it was easily the most impressive church John had ever seen, he was quite sure he'd never been to this place before. But the closer he got, the stronger this sense of deja vu became. It started to become overwhelming. They stopped at the base of a long flight of steps. John gets out of the car and he starts walking up towards the front doors of the cathedral. The place is made of, it's like chrome and glittering glass, majestic. But then John realized that it wasn't the building, it wasn't the cathedral that was giving him these feelings. It was that teenage girl standing in front of it. This girl wasn't wearing robes, she didn't have on a mask. And he saw she was staring at him with tears rolling down her face. Mr. Horrod touched his shoulder and said, I told you that you would see her again. John, this is Rachel Sunday. Big brother and baby sister embraced. She cried into his chest. He stroked her hair. But over the top of her head, he looked at Mr. Horrod, and he gave him a little subtle nod. Because he knew what was expected of him, and he understood what would have to be done. Ladies and gentlemen, you may have read the papers or the book. You may think you know who John Sunday is. You may think you know who the machinist is. But honestly, you haven't even heard the best part yet. Here's this kid, 17 years old, raised to be a remorseless killer. He's an heir to a massive global demonic cult. And all that stands in the way of him ascending is a single life. Human life doesn't matter to John Sunday, but this may be the only life that does. On the other hand, it may not mean anything at all. Don't you dare miss part two of The Machinist, The Return of the Blood King.